Hi there, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell a chronological account of the events in and around London as it travelled through history in the form of a grand narrative tale. Last chapter we covered political events taking place in London in the immediate aftermath of the first outbreak of the Black Death. But while this was happening, England itself was facing an increasingly interesting time, and the focus of all of this was its king, Edward III. We saw last chapter how Edward was being a no-nonsense type of king, a powerful and stern ruler over his nation, and we discussed how his policies had caused massive changes within the city. He'd removed the privileges of London, had banned wool exporting by English merchants, and had ignored the pleas, bribes and protestations from Londoners to return things back to what they were before. As such, London was changing as a city. From across England, new migrants were turning up, buying properties, setting up businesses, making money formerly made by and exclusively by Londoners. Meanwhile, Italians and Germans were making a killing, and certain professions, the vintners, the mercers, the fishmongers, and a score of small craftsmen were suffering from a massive contraction of profits and wages. Meanwhile, while this is going on, other Londoners, the newly empowered grocers, were adapting to the new situation and profiting. This group being born out of an unlikely combination of men from across the city coming together within the fraternity of the Church of St. Athelin, based over in Cordwainer Ward. And all of this was due to the actions, policies and decisions of this king. But London was not Edward III's principal focus, far from it. He had much bigger fish to fry. He had a nation to run, he had a war to win. The largest war England had ever seen, by the way. A highly expensive campaign raging across France and Scotland. And more than any of that, the Edward III before the Black Death was not really the same king as he was after the Black Death. He had new ambitions. And while it's not really said, while Edward III and the Hundred Years' War and all of that is often seen as the height of the medieval period, in reality, it could be argued that he was the first Renaissance King of England, that this bloody and brutal monarch actually heralded in a glorious new age for the country. Now, that last sentence is one heck of a big claim, and I figure I better present my side of the argument and back it up. And so, without further ado, welcome then to Chapter 125 of The Story of London, A Very English Renaissance. For me, if you want to get a real insight into the kind of king Edward III was, stripping away all the propaganda and also the deconstruction of his character, then there are a couple of things he did during the plague that kind of stand out. They denote his character. Now, the first was his visit to Calais at the start of the outbreak, and then him remaining in Westminster and London for much of it during 1348. The king did not run. He witnessed the horrors ongoing on his doorstep, and he remained a stalwart, at least until his advisers basically begged him to withdraw to somewhere less lethal than London and Westminster. But the other thing he did took place at the very height of the plague, that era when 200 men, women and children were dying every single day in the city. You had the nobility of England at the time mostly hiding in their isolated manors up and down the country. You had a secondary epidemic, a great murrain of cattle, which saw sheep and cows dying in their thousands across the country. You had an England where the social order seemed to be fraying, if not falling apart. And at this darkest hour, King Edward then ignored the advice of his physicians. He could see England needed leadership. And he was the King of England, chosen by God. He could do nothing to halt the plague, but he could demonstrate effective leadership, as contextualized by the time, in the face of all of this. And so he also formed a club. Like the Fraternity of St. Etheline, it was a quasi-religious group of friends and associates, but that's where the similarity ends. This group were not merchants. They were rather powerful, big man tanks in armour, and they gathered at a huge, high-profile tournament that the king held at Windsor Castle. And this group would become the most prestigious order of knights in Europe, the Order of the Knights of the Garter. The creation of this group was a highly political gesture. On one hand, it demonstrated to his subjects that their king was not hiding away in some out-of-the-way manner, waiting for the all clear, unlike all the other lords and bishops of England at the time. This tournament was an act of defiance, an act of bravery. In the face of the greatest pandemic ever known by man, the king was bravely creating something splendid and glorious, an event steeped in pageantry, symbolism, and warfare. Of course, this also runs into a secondary and slightly unusual issue. Why the hell would you call the most powerful group of knights in Europe the Knights of the Garter? Believe it or not, there's been a lot written about this by various historians. And it's worth keeping in mind, like his grandfather, Edward I, Edward III was a bit of a fanboy for King Arthur. He wanted to emulate himself on this mythic and idealized imaginary king, whose traits and personalities turned out to be utterly based on those of King William II of England, something I discussed all the way back in chapter 54 of this story. So him creating a small cadre of the finest knights in the land around him at Windsor, now that made total sense. What doesn't is why give it that weird name. The Garter has no symbolism to do with the plague that was exploding all around them, and it wasn't a standard piece of knight's equipment, and it doesn't have any symbolic religious meaning, and it certainly didn't have any Arthurian meaning. Now, we actually do know that the symbol of a garter and the order's rather unusual French motto, and it's unusual as King Edward liked a good motto, but they were always in English when he coined them, had been turning up in tournaments from as early as 1346. So what made him pick that symbol? Well, there are a surprisingly varied plethora of theories out there. Some historians suggest that the adoration of the garter and the motto in French had something to do with Edward's claim to the French throne. The problem is, that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, a man's garter is hardly a fearsome article of clothing and is not associated with dominion over the French in particular. Others have suggested the garter was symbolic of a sword belt. The problem with that theory? Then why not call the order the Knights of the Sword Belt? The origin probably lies in the use of the symbol before that tournament in Windsor at the height of the plague. The symbol and the motto seem to have been used by the king's second cousin, the most feared and brilliant of his commanders of his armed forces, the Welsh-born but French-speaking Henry of Gosmont, better known as the Earl and later Duke of Lancaster. Records say he wore garters in his youth, and back in 1345 he built upon his growing reputation as leader of English forces in Scotland by being stunning, leading English forces in Gascony. His success made the symbol be seen as the chivalric symbol, and it had the advantage that it was highly visible, it could be worn over plate armour, it was useful. So when Prince Edward presented garters to the 24 Companions of the Garter in 1348, all those recipients were probably members of a company, an unofficial jousting fraternity, who had been formed in honour of a victorious war leader, the Earl of Lancaster, serving a glorious King Edward III. I mean, if we take it that the symbol and the motto originated with Lancaster, then other things make sense. I mean, it would explain why the language of the motto is different from Edward's other ones. French was Lancaster's first language, and though he did speak English, French was certainly his language of choice. I mean, he wrote a book in it, after all. And as well as this, King Edward had a bloody good reason not to anglicise this motto in 1349, because only a French or Latin motto would have been suitable for an order, which included Hainaultiers and Gascons as well as Englishmen. To have used an English motto would have alienated some of the non-English members of the order and their companions and made it an inward-looking English-only institution, not the outward-looking pan-European one King Edward wanted to create. And to go back to our central point, to understand why Edward III created this order, we really need to look at its purpose. In April 1349, Edward was bringing together his long-standing ambition to create a chivalric order, built upon a close body of jousters he got on with, and formed to celebrate his victories over the French and those of the second name in the order's knights, the Earl of Lancaster. But ultimately, he wanted to do this as a very high-profile publicity stunt, brought on by his need to do something in the face of the plague, to show he was bold, unafraid, glorious, to remind his people their king was this kind of ruler. It worked a treat, by the way. Now, I mention this simply because you do need to understand the bloody-mindedness of this king. He was a man who acted very boldly. Wisely? Maybe not. But bold action was his idiom. And that may help to explain the other thing he did in 1349, which was to impact upon England on a much longer term basis. See, the plague was everywhere, and because of this, prices went up and wages doubled. To quote a contemporary writer at the time, quote, "In the following autumn, no one could get a reaper for less than 8 pence with food, or a mower for less than 12 pence with food. For this reason, many crops perished in the fields for lack of harvesters," unquote. You see, the problem was, medieval English society was in no way at all flexible. When one sector experienced a crisis, the entire thing reeled, unable to adapt by assigning tasks to new people. And in 1349, most of the systems in place that kept this medieval society running simply collapsed. Let me give you an example. Men who had just lost their wives and children could have provided a mobile workforce, but that would only have worked if they broke their feudal bonds and left their manors from which they were bound to work. And faced with starvation, this is what they did in many places. Hence, you'd find a memorial bailiff, having lost a third or half his workforce to the plague, now find the remainder threatening to leave unless he paid them double the usual wages. This was threatening the established social order. Manorial lords didn't normally need to buy food. If they were short, they could requisition it from their demesne farms. But now, not only had their workforce died, and the remainder gone off to work for someone else, their own animals were dying in the fields. They had cows to milk, but no one to milk them. They had sheep to shear, but no one to shear them. They could not now pay their tithes to the church, and so the clergy suddenly found it could not function. And so with this in mind, suddenly Edward's reaction makes total sense. It was simple logic. All the economic damage would be minimized if those workers who survived the plague remained on their estates and worked for the same wages as before. Therefore, this was behind the idea of trying to maintain the status quo as far as possible. And that's why Edward issued the royal ordinance, the Statute of Labourers, which we've covered in detail over the last few chapters. But we can also say that this policy was doomed from the moment it was born. I mean, when labour supply is short and currency supply unchanged, wage inflation was inevitable. But judgments based in hindsight mostly just reveal the ignorance of the one making the judgment. In 1349, it was difficult to understand how society was changing and impossible to see how high wages and large amounts of derelict property could actually benefit the nation. The Statute of Labourers in 1349 should be seen as an identical action as the Grand Windsor Tournament creating the Knights of the Garter. It was propaganda. It was saying we can remain stable. It was saying England endures. And it was reminding everyone who was in charge. And in that respect, this also worked, because while we know there was a lot of resentment towards this law, and it was to cause London a shedload of issues, this law was enforced. The regime continued. Stability won over the aftermath of the plague. In this respect, Edward III is no forward-thinking Renaissance leader. Here he is, desperately clinging onto the vestiges of the past, reinforcing the medieval society that gave birth to him. So where does this idea of him being influenced by the Renaissance come from? Well, I'll get back to that. Of course, while the plague was going on, the biggest threat to the regime of Edward III was not that. There was a war going on, one that had been winning before the plague erupted. But with the plague, all bets were off. And by the August of 1349, King Philip of France decided to break the truce which had been in place during the Black Death. We don't know why he decided to attack. Theories say that he was provoked by small-scale raids of the Gascons, who were Edward's subjects and were kind of guilty of endlessly attacking the neighbouring French. Or others suggested that given the losses England had endured, the French king thought that Edward could not defend his new conquests. But for whatever reason, the French began raising an army to attack the English in Gascony. England was just beginning to emerge from the plague and to begin to rebuild economically. Edward III was caught out on the hop. He had no cards to play, but the obvious. He needed to mount a spirited defence down there, and he did have one trump card, the Earl of Lancaster, whose very name struck fear into his adversaries. That was the easy part of the reply to this attack by the French. But there was a complication. Edward had a commander to send to France, but he didn't have any men to send with him. The plague had prevented any large armies from being gathered. As it was, all the Earl of Lancaster could do was go on a rampage with about 300 men across southwest France, burning, pillaging, and hoping to scare the French back to the negotiating table. But what actually got the French back to the negotiating table was they decided to hand the king his fourth great victory. So far, he'd ground out a massive strategic conquest with the fall of Calais, the glory of the Battle of Crecy, and, of course, the naval domination that came with victory at the Battle of Sluys. But it was now time to add a fourth victory to his list, and that was to happen in Calais. See, the fall of the town to the English had just festered in the minds of the French. It was a greater loss to them, as had been the Battle of Crecy. Their options to take it back, however, were limited. I mean, they could besiege the city, but since the Battle of Sluys, the English dominated the English Channel and could break up any siege with naval reinforcement. And so they decided where warfare would not work, duplicity would have to do. The French decided to approach an Italian called Emiec de Pavia. This Italian mercenary pirate had once been employed by the French to fight against the English. He'd been one of the defenders of Calais. He'd actually been in Calais as they saw the French refuse to ride to its rescue during the siege. And he'd been one of the defenders who'd surrendered to this English king. Edward III was quick to offer the mercenary a good wage to work for him now. And de Pavia was now the captain of the king's galleys at Calais. Quietly, the leading French commanders approached de Pavia in secret and offered him 40,000 florins if he would arrange for the back gate to the city to be left open one night. De Pavia agreed to the scheme. He did, and then he promptly sent word to King Edward III telling him the entire thing. King Edward saw a way to save Calais, grab some money for himself, and give the French a very bloody nose at the same time. The king, along with a cabal of new knights of the garter, rode to Westminster, where he gathered up a few hundred archers, possibly Londoners or men from nearby London, and in order to ensure no one heard what he was up to, he ordered that no one was allowed to leave London and said that was because of the plague. Then he went down to the coast and crossed with his knights, retainers and archers and ended up in Calais himself. If those archers had have been Londoners or men from near London, what would they have seen? Well, when they got there, Edward and his son and others supposedly went anonymously through the streets, dressed up as merchants. Few of the townsmen actually knew who they were. This gave Edward a few days to prepare. The date set for betrayal of the town was the night of December the 1st, and in that time he ordered a false stone wall to be built inside one of the postern gates. He partially weakened the drawbridge, and he stationed a large stone on the battlements of the gatehouse above. Then he and his men settled down to await the betrayal in a room in the castle in the town. Towards midnight, a French advance party rode up to the postern gate. They found the drawbridge down and the gate open, and there was Emiec de Pavia waiting for his cash. And having received it, and declaring that there was no time to count it just yet, he led them into the castle to allow them to signal to their fellow troops outside the wall to come on in. The room he led them to was, of course, the one that the king and his knights were hiding in. They were captured without a fight, and that done, Edward and the rest of his men supposedly took up positions behind the false wall, which had been built carefully without mortar, stones just resting on one another. The group who'd gone in with de Pavia had instructions to raise the French flag over the castle if all was safe for the main army to enter the town through the main gate. It was the English who raised the French banners to lure the French force in. When a sufficient number had entered, trumpets sounded, and down went the stone on the drawbridge with a crash, cutting the troops off in the town from their fellow men. And then down went that false wall too, and the English attacked. Then the king tackled one of the principal commanders of the French army and beat him to his knees. And then, with about 30 knights and a few archers, the king ran out of the town to attack the rest of the French. This is officially insane. Edward was facing about 800 French men at arms, and he ordered a few archers who had followed him to take position and shoot at any man who approached. And then he revealed he was there, crying out, "St. Edward and St. George!" If that's true, it's amazing. The bewildered French men at arms suddenly found themselves in an extraordinary situation. They have an English king standing before them, outnumbered probably about 20-1, and yet preparing for a scrap. Edward wasn't alone for long. Soon his son, Edward the Prince of Wales, caught up with his father, and the two men ploughed into the French lines. The French broke. Calais had been saved, the money seized, and Edward had got a bunch of valuable prisoners. This was brilliant. And with this defeat, the French grudgingly returned to the negotiating table, and hard talks followed. Edward was now the personification of his own Arthurian dreams. A magnanimous, ferocious king, always daring, always brilliant, always generous, charismatic and chivalrous, a hero to his people, even if the part of his nation was suffering under laws which ignored the reality of the world. And more glory was to follow. Because in 1350, a new front in the war opened up, as King Alfonso of Castilla had died of the plague, and his fleet and the fleet of the Castilians was now firmly on the side of the French and engaging in acts of piracy against the English shipping in the region. This was mostly due to King Philip of France having offered large sums of cash to rent the ships of the Spaniards. And this was actually a significant change. The Castilian ships were on the whole much larger than English ships. And as far as the English were concerned, a Castilian navy in the region was a big invasion threat. Now, the records of the time record a mammoth battle involving King Edward III, but I think it'd be fair to say this is only because records of the time like to write about things that kings and noble lords were involved with. Chances are it's highly likely there'd been a long-running campaign of conflict between numerous Castilian and English ships all over the Channel and the Bay of Biscay, especially given the Castilians had made no secret of their desire to capture and seize merchant ships carrying wine from Gascony to London. But this eventually led to what was known as the Battle of Winchelsea, wherein the king supposedly was in the thick of the fighting on board a cog called the Thomas, and his son Edward, the Prince of Wales, was also heavily involved, and even his 10-year-old son, John of Gaunt, was there serving alongside his older brother. Tales of daring do supposedly followed, and the battle is presented as a great English victory that drove the Spanish back and kept the Channel free from Spanish pirates for decades. Chances are it didn't actually do that. Castilia fell into a long-running civil war soon after, and that probably kept the sea lanes free from pirates. But why allow facts get in the way of great propaganda? And in truth be told, the French themselves barely even noticed the Battle of Winchelsea, because a week before, King Philip of France had died. And this news was greeted with a sense of relief by the French. Philip had made an enemy out of Edward III, who was his cousin, as we've discussed in the past. And since that moment, he'd been repeatedly out-negotiated, outwitted, defeated, and humiliated by his glorious English cousin. Philip was ultimately a very insecure man. He'd lambast his own people when things went bad. After the defeat at Crecy, he was said to be a broken man. After the fall of Calais, he was said to have a broken regime. And then he made it worse. When his wife, the Queen of France, died of plague, a month later the 56-year-old married a 17-year-old Blanche de Evreux, who was awkwardly at the time betrothed to his son John. This was not a good look for Philip, and it alienated his son, and overall his death was seen as somewhat of a relief, and he was generally judged to have been as disastrous to the French as Edward II had been to the English. But that great victory for Edward III in the Battle of Winchelsea marked an important moment in Edward III's life, because never again would he personally enter battle again. The experiences of the plague and renewed war seemed to have changed him. From now on, Edward III began to focus on his legacy. While war would continue to be a constant in his regime, Edward himself sought out a greater sense of meaning in his life. If you think about it, this makes sense. It may have been the plague, or it may have been his age. He was now 37, or perhaps both. but it was at this point that Edward began to draw back from martial activities to create a more lasting legacy. It showed itself in building. He rebuilt and redesigned Windsor Castle, turning it from its former role as the bastion of the Plantagenet kings and the hulking feared symbol of royal authority into which mayors of London had been jailed in the past, into something much more glorious, much more recognisable to us today. He turned it into the largest, grandest, the most opulent palace in Northern Europe. I mean, to put it into scale, his grandfather, Edward I, had constructed 8 Welsh castles, built between 1277 and 1304, and that's generally seen as one of the most significant building programmes undertaken during the medieval era. The entire cost of all 8 was £95,000. Edward III spent more than £50,000 on Windsor Castle alone. And yet few people today connect Windsor Castle with Edward III. Why? Well, probably because Edward's main works at Windsor were not open to the public. They were private. And they were internal buildings. They're living and ceremonial quarters, which have been repeatedly adopted to suit the tastes of each monarch that ever followed him. What the public see today from the outside, the castle, is largely the restored 12th and 13th century stonework. It was inside this impressive shell, which was the largest residential castle in the world, that Edward created a massive monument to his glorious reign. The internal reconstruction of Windsor Castle as the greatest medieval palace in England took about 18 years. Practically every major artist and craftsman in the country was at some time or another employed on building it. And this was not the only building project going on, far from it. And London was to witness many of these extraordinary buildings. The nearest, of course, being in the Palace of Westminster. The most obvious sign of Edward's largesse in Westminster was the completion of St. Stephen's Chapel, the principal place of royal worship within the palace. This had been ordered to be completely rebuilt by the king's grandfather, Edward I, in 1292. And over the next 60 years, progress had been slow. It often stalled completely. Now Edward III was determined to finish it, and he did. William Hurley, the king's master carpenter, and William Ramsay, surveyor of the king's work, were put in charge. By 1348, the exquisite chapel, 90 feet long and 30 feet wide, was complete, with a gallery leading directly from the king's chamber into the upper part. All that needed to be done now was to glaze it, paint it, and furnish the chapel. One of the great tragedies of English history was that this chapel was pulled down after the fire of 1834, which unfortunately destroyed most of the old Palace of Westminster. But what is especially sad was that this amazing decoration was almost entirely lost in that fire. Because the truth was, at St. Stephen's Chapel, King Edward commissioned what is generally recognised to be the most magnificent English painting programme of the 14th century. It is tempting to say the English had not seen painting like this before, because many of the techniques used were exclusively connected with the paintings of the Italian Renaissance, the use of perspective, for example. But surprisingly, these painters seem to have been all English. Every part of the chapel wall was painted. Spaces below the windows were adorned with religious subjects. The corners of the windows were painted or gilded. The walls themselves were covered with angels with extended wings and doves, and with images of elephants, eagles, and castles. Beneath the great east window, there were said to be painted figures of St. George, King Edward himself, Queen Philippa, and 10 of their sons and daughters. Only some incomplete sketches made of these images now survive. The originals destroyed in that terrible fire. A few small fragments of the paintings were rescued, and these are now in the British Museum. Otherwise, everything was lost. But the truth was, Edward did not stop at employing the best painters at St. Stephen's. He also employed the best carpenters, the finest glaziers, and the most skilled carvers of wood and stone. That chapel, had it survived, would have been a very English representation of the Italian Renaissance. And this is not as absurd as it sounds. Consider Edward's extended family links with southern European families, such as the Counts of Savoy and Provence. He had, over the years, been as familiar with Italian culture as his forefathers. For years, through all gift-giving and gift-receiving, Edward had seen the best of Italian craftsmen. The banking families of the Peruzzi and the Bardi had practically lived in his palaces for 7 years. And in 1340, the head of the Peruzzi actually died in London after spending a year with Edward. Some of his doctors were Italian. Some of his clerks were Italian, as were some of his armourers. He purchased paintings and armour from Italy. As a result, it would be wrong to even think that Edward III did not have knowledge of the Renaissance taking place in Italy. And meanwhile, his glorious building projects continued. Those merchants from London passing down river would pass the new Queensborough Castle on the Isle of Sheppey. He founded a convent at nuns at Dartford, dependent on the Dominican friars, a unique establishment. His work rebuilding Eltham Palace began in 1350, lasted for 10 years and cost over £2,000. And building there included new lodgings for the royal family, passages between the King's Great Chamber and the Queen's. He rebuilt the encircling wall, repaired the halls, plural, the King's Chapel and the gatehouses, added a new drawbridge, a new kitchen, a roasting house, a sorcery, a larder and an oratory. He also restocked and repaired the garden and improved the vineyard in Eltham. In 1351, he acquired Henley from John Manners and started rebuilding a royal residence there. 2 years later, he commenced work at Rotherhithe on the south bank of the Thames. There he spent over £1,000 on the next 3 years on a fine house with a wharf, gardens and vineyards to be a convenient stopping-off point on his journeys into Kent. It was in the same year he began work of his great palace over at Sheen near Richmond, where he spent more than £2,000 on an exquisite new royal house, with fish ponds, gardens, tile courtyards and chambers with large fireplaces. The king was leaving his stamp all over the Thames Valley in the form of magnificent and stately buildings, and his love of innovation didn't end there. The water supply, the bathroom in the Palace of Westminster had been controlled by bronze taps in the shape of leopards, probably attached to metal cisterns, since around about 1275. But Edward III had come up with a new way of heating the water in this place, and it is said that he introduced what was probably the first English bathroom with hot and cold running water, with one bronze tap for hot and another for cold. In 1352, he also paid for three Italians to make him a mechanical timepiece in London. This and a large bell onto which it would regularly chime the hours were transported from London to Windsor and set up in the Great Tower there. It had no face, but it rang out the intervals hourly. Edward's first mechanical clock is very interesting development into itself, because when you think about the subtle implications of regulating time in this period, it suddenly becomes apparent that King Edward was at the forefront of a profound European revolution. Medieval people generally divided the day into 12 hours of the night and 12 hours of the day. The day started with daylight, so each of the 12 hours of daylight in the summer was, you know, twice as long as an hour of daylight in the winter. Edward, in introducing a regular timepiece, was attempting to standardise time. Moreover, he was doing it in his own castle within 15 years of the introduction of the practice in one of the most advanced cities at the heart of Renaissance Italy. And nor was this just an idle experiment. The clock at Windsor lasted, so much so it needed a new bell, and by 1377 it's been described as a clocky, the earliest recorded use of the word in English derived from the French word cloche, meaning bell. Long before then, Edward had purchased additional bell-striking clocks and had placed one at Westminster. At Westminster, he built a bell tower to contain a great bell inscribed with Edward. This weighed 4 tons and rang the hour at Westminster for more than 300 years. It's been described as the original Big Ben, the Big Edward. The implication of all of this is that he was regulating his household and his own life, not around the traditional long and short hours of the day, but with a standard unit of time measurement. Although none of Edward's clocks have survived, they nevertheless had important cultural influence. In the same way, his buildings, his paintings and other commissions, even his long-lost plate and costumes had an influence, just as Edward's preference for mechanically regulated hours. This draws our attention to those other aspects of Edward's cultural patronage, which have been obscured by his reputation as being a warrior. Literature was never thought to be an area in which Edward scored highly, except into his employment of Chaucer. But we now know that King Edward was an avid reader. He kept a library of over 160 books at the Tower of London, with more in his other palaces. He loaned them out to other members of his court and borrowed books from them on a regular basis. And as well as a bevy of liturgical works such as graduals, missals, antiphons, chorals, mythologies and gospels, his interests extended to military strategy, history and alchemy. Alchemy, that most primitive version of what would eventually be called science, was an idea that interested him. We know he summoned two alchemists who claimed to have made silver to his court, and a major alchemical text was dedicated to him. He also liked to collect wild animals. Edward kept a huge menagerie of wild beasts, especially large cats, and even paid for them to be taken with him around the country. We know one Italian merchant was paid for providing Edward with additions to his collections, supplying two lions, three leopards, and a mountain cat. In 1344, he took these animals north with him when he moved the royal household to York. And then when his attention turned to France, he returned them back to the Tower of London. He also owned a bear, given to him years earlier by King David of Scotland. In later years, he supplemented this with wild leopards and lions, including a gift of live animals from the Black Prince in 1365. Of course, Edward III's collection of rare species has been eclipsed by the knowledge that Henry III had an elephant. But that all of these beasts were kept in the Tower of London is interesting, as that was where the unofficial royal lending library was. The Tower of London as a resort of learning is not one image we associate with the place, but it does seem to have held that role during Edward's reign. His love of books and learning were to sow important seeds. It is in the literary creations encouraged by the successes of his reign that we find those seeds grown fruit. So the poetry of Chaucer, Gower and Langland, and the histories of his exploits in the works of Le Baker, Frisson, Gray, Murrymuth, Avesbury. But the foundations of such writing were clearly laid out in the courtly patronage of Edward III. By 1370, Edward had spent a total of more than £130,000 on building work. All of this is just me pointing out that King Edward III was the greatest cultural patron of the late Middle Ages, and the man who introduced the Renaissance to England. Dismissing him as just a warlord king would have a hard time reconciling this image with towers that rang the hours every hour over Westminster and hot and cold running taps. Anyway, let's get back to the war, as that was his pressing political issue. Not long after King Philip died and King John took over, Edward asked the Pope to appoint an English cardinal. I mean, the popes were based in Avignon, most of the cardinals were French, and to have an English voice there would have been a sensible move. And the Pope responded favourably, making Edward put forward two suitable candidates, and one of which was Ralph Sandwich, the Bishop of London. London got all excited, it could have a cardinal. The Pope, however, was just playing him along. In December 17th, 1350, in the presence of the newly crowned King, John of France, 12 cardinals were created, including 8 more Frenchmen, 3 Spaniards and an Italian. The English candidates were ignored. It's in light of this, it's not really surprising that Edward was keen to pass a subsequent petition for a statute prohibiting papal appointments. French antagonism was extreme. The feeling in France and the fear in England was that King John needed to begin his reign by taking the fight to the English. There were small-scale skirmishes, many of them, throughout 1351. Then disaster struck. The English garrison of Calais had gone out to conduct a raid on French territory, and they were ambushed on the way back, and that seriously weakened the amount of defenders in Calais. And then Flanders decided to side with the French against the English, and King John decided to celebrate this by establishing his own chivalric order, the Order of the Star. Edward realised they needed to end this war. He was trying desperately to negotiate some kind of peace deal. And then someone, some little person, complicated things. Despite the truce going on between the two nations, an English squire called John Doncaster led an attack on the castle of Guines. Guines was 6 miles south of Calais and was considered impregnable and the greatest threat to security off Calais. On the night he decided to launch an attack, the castle commander was away being honoured as a founder member of the new Order of the Star, and as he was sitting eating off gold plates in King John's presence, John Doncaster and a few other squires basically blackened their faces, climbed over the walls into the castle, killed the sentries and seized the castle. It was an almost unbelievable piece of good fortune. It was also in violation with the truth of the French, and actually it being French emissaries, not English messengers, who had brought the news to the king. Edward had a dilemma. I mean, on the one hand, he would be tempted to acknowledge Doncaster's victory as a massive English success. On the other hand, it would mean he'd have to start the war up again. Edward decided to seek the advice of his parliament, and to the dismay of the French, they all said, yeah, sounds great, go for it. So he pardoned Doncaster for any wrongdoing and rewarded him. The French reaction was immediately to fight. French army started assembling, and it became clear that Edward underestimated the fury that his decision would unleash. But slowly, the writs went out to draw spearmen from across the country, and archers as well. But even then, Edward was cautious about getting too deeply involved. When the English defence did get underway, it proved stunningly effective. A contingent from Calais joined men at Guines in attacking the French and burning down their siege engines, and eventually the French were forced to retreat, and above all in Gascony and Brittany, the English kept winning battles. But the war carried on for the next few years. Now, while the next series of events in the Hundred Years' War are fascinating and a rich story of duplicity, betrayal and murder, this podcast is supposedly dedicated to London and the events there, and I will be coming back to it. So I'm now going to cut out the entire fascinating story of King Charles of Navarre, one of French history's most least likable characters. Basically, long story short, Charles of Navarre and his brother Philip murdered the Constable of France, stabbing the poor man 80 times. Facing the wrath of King John, they went over to Edward, begging for English help. They would support his claim for the throne if he could supply them troops. But then they went back in the ward and made peace with King John and planned to betray the English. Luckily, the English got word of this, but it ended up with the King and the Duke of Lancaster in Normandy with a large army and his son Edward the Black Prince in Gascony with a small army. But the French king wouldn't meet him in battle, no matter what the provocation, and then news arrived of a Scottish attack on Berwick. Edward had not taken the precautions he usually took to defend his northern border when invading France, and so he had to go all the way back to Scotland to deal with that. And that was humiliating, and he was angry. The shame he felt in retreating from France now driving him forward. Scotland was going to pay the price. The campaign which followed became infamous in Scotland as the Burnt Candlemas. Edward set about organising a destructive march across Scotland based on those he'd used in France, an advancing front 20 miles wide in which everything was destroyed and burnt. It began at Roxburgh on January 26 and continued day by day until Edward marched into Edinburgh, the lower parts of the city he burnt on Candlemas Day on the 2nd of February. He then moved on to Haddington, which he also burnt, and then a bitter winter campaign followed as Edward destroyed everything in his path on the way across the lowlands to Carlisle. Soon after Burnt Candlemas, Edward agreed to peace with the Scots and resumed negotiations to allow King David to return to his kingdom. The conflict with Scotland effectively ended there, not to be resumed during his lifetime, and David returned to his inheritance. Now, historians often stress how bloody expensive King Edward's military campaigns were, but that's largely because English records survive in great numbers, allowing the figures to be discussed in fine detail. Had French records survived as well, they would have shown that the defence of France was equally expensive. Neither King John nor his father Philip had ever come close to making ends meet. Frequent attempts had been made to raise money for the French royal treasury by devaluing the currency, but successive devaluations have undermined all confidence in it. By 1356, King John was bankrupt. When his government attempted to tackle this by raising a sales tax and a salt tax, the response was a very familiar sight of Frenchmen holding riots. John's biggest problem in 1356 was the Prince of Wales. Having sailed for Gascony in September 1355, the prince had been well received and successful throughout the duchy. In October, he led a successful raid through Armagnac. He'd even reached the walls of Carcassonne before returning to Bordeaux, and he burnt everything he could. It's not possible for John to ignore the scale of the devastation. It was even more severe than Burnt Candlemas. Whole towns were destroyed, including Carcassonne itself and Limoux, where 4,000 houses were burnt. The young prince's men had looted huge amounts of treasure and added even more to King John's financial problems. They even stole financial documents from towns they burnt in order to calculate how much damage they were doing to the French treasury. Pleased with the success of his son and satisfied his subdued the Scots, Edward turned more again to diplomatic solutions. He needed to persuade the French that they stood to gain from accepting peace on his terms. Edward launched another invasion, but the purpose was to increase the pressure, and no attempt was made to link up with the prince in the south of France. And that's where major events were going to take place. Edward, the Prince of Wales, had marched north from Gascony, seeking out news of this northern landing. When he discovered there'd be no meet-up with the northern English forces, the prince had to reassess his situation. King John was at Orléans with a large army, and the prince heard that the French royal army was marching south. He had no choice at this point except to retreat. French emissaries sought him out. They offered this young prince a chance to sue for peace on terms favourable to the French. He refused and sent scouts to search out for King John. They found him at Poitiers on the 18th of September. As the prince began to arrange his men on the edge of a wooded hillside in case of attack, a new peace offer was made. If the prince was to give up all his prisoners and all the land he'd captured and agree to not make war in France for 7 years, he and his men would be spared and allowed to go free. After all, King John had more than 14,000 men with him, and Prince Edward had only 6,000, and only about 1,000 of his archers. The prince acknowledged this was the fact, and he told the emissaries that he'd agree to the terms suggested. Just one condition. I just need my father to agree, he said. He was playing for time, but that clearly annoyed King John. On the 19th of September, the French advanced their crossbowmen and shield-bearers. King John unfurled the Oriflamme, the great symbol of French royalty, and issued an order to put all the English and Gascon to death. All prisoners taken were to be killed. The one exception was to be the young Black Prince himself. There was nothing further to be done now in the English camp but prepare for a battle after a night, trying to sleep on a hillside in armour. Mass was heard, prayers were said. The prince went amongst his men, encouraging them. Two groups of French cavalry had been selected, each 500 strong, to ride ahead to break up the ranks of archers, which they suspected would be arranged on either side of the English position. Their horses had been specially armoured to enable them to do this, but the men in charge were unable to see how they could charge into the archers. At first they could not see the English position at all, and so were unsure what they were aiming at, and they hesitated. And then in their pride, misinformation and nerves got the better, and they charged pell-mell. As the French crossbowmen came forward, letting fly their deadly bolts at the prince's men in front of them, the English vanguard, under the command of the Earl of Warwick, charged up the hill at the prince's right to attack them on their left flank and drove them back towards the main body. Warwick's men then found themselves under attack from the French cavalry. Caught in the open between the archers and the charge, they took shelter behind a thick hedge. In the middle of the hedge was a wide gap, and the French riders now tried to force their way in. Here in the Earl of Salisbury, seeing this, forced his own men into the breach and fended off both cavalry charges. The whole French first attack fell back, and they impeded the advance of troops under the Dauphin, who were coming up trying to take on the English, which slowed them down, and that attack failed. King John now staked everything on just one final, oh for God's sake, huge onslaught. His plan was to concentrate all his forces on the English in the front of the prince, hoping to overwhelm and crush them simply by sheer force of numbers. He ordered the entire French army to advance in one massive battalion. When the size of the French army became obvious to the English, and then word got out that the English archers had run out of arrows, the English actually began to panic. They said they should flee while they could. They'd been beaten. According to the wonderful stories, the prince rallied his men, saying that whoever says they were beaten was lying. He was alive, wasn't he? In the terrifying minutes before this huge wave of Frenchmen came upon them, the English ran forward to yank out the arrows from the corpses and still wounded lying in the battlefield in front of them and give them to any archer they could find. Across the wide battlefield, men realised they had to stand together. The prince knew he needed a surprise element, so he ordered a small contingent under the Garter Knight, Sir Jean de Grailly, to leave the battlefield and rush to attack the French from behind. The other English saw this famous warrior banner leaving the battlefield and thought he was fleeing. They began to shout in dismay. At the critical moment, just when the English army was about to break up and run, The prince made one of the bravest, most important and unexpected decisions of the entire war. He controlled the urge to flee by ordering his army to advance. The English and Gascons had to steady their nerves or break ranks. Terrified though they probably were, uncertain as they were, they did not fail. This was incredibly brave. In spite of any fear they held, they marched, as was ordered, straight towards the Oriflamme, the symbol which meant their deaths. And as they advanced, Sir de Grailly was running unseen around the woods towards the French rear. On marched the prince, his trumpeters beside him, his army around him, gathering in resolution. Then at the critical moment, the prince signalled to his trumpeters to sound the charge. Men started running. The mounted contingents charged. The archers loosed their last arrows and then threw away their bows and drew their knives. They ran at the French. Infantry, knights and men at arms all rushed forward, waving swords, maces, spears, axes, shouting the war cry of St. George! He crashed into the French infantry, each side furiously intent on one single strategic aim, kill as many people as possible. In the ensuing struggle, as men wrestled and hit each other and beat each other's head with stones, stabbed each other, slashed each other, it was the English who generally began to prevail. The forces around King John were pushed back, and then Jean de Grailly appeared in the rear, unfurling the banner of St. George, seemingly stopping a French retreat. There was carnage and chaos. The French began to fall. It was a battle totally unlike any other of the English victories over the last 23 years. It had not been won by English archers being arranged on the flanks of the English army. It had been won by sheer grit and determination. It was, to use the Duke of Wellington's expression, a damn near run thing. But like that other damn near run thing, the result was a devastating victory. The news spread north. It reached Brittany and then passed on to Cherbourg and then passed on to the king. There had been a great battle at Poitiers on the 19th of September. The English had been victorious. The young Prince of Wales was safe and well. And more than that, King John of France had been captured. The King of France had been captured? This was extraordinary. It had never happened before. Edward was explosively happy. He rewarded the messenger who told him this with 25 marks of silver there and then, and he gave orders for the news to be cried out around the country. Archbishops and bishops throughout England asked to offer up thanksgiving for the prince's success. The whole country was astounded. Surely this was an end to the war. Fouissant noted that, quote, great solemnities were made in all churches and great fires and celebrations were held throughout the land, unquote. 2,300 French knights and men-at-arms had been killed, not including infantry, and 2,500 men of quality had been captured, as well as the French king. The news rocked the French Pope in Avignon. It astounded all of Europe, and all credit would go to King Edward as well as his son. For the first time in its history, England was more than just a southern part of the island of the north coast of Europe. It was the dominant military nation in Christendom. There was a sense of euphoria about the English court after the arrival of that news from Poitiers. With one battle, the political map of Europe had been withdrawn. In May 1357, the Prince of Wales landed at Plymouth with the King of France and his prisoners and rode slowly in procession towards London through Salisbury, Sherborne and Winchester. Everywhere they went, there were wild scenes. And then they reached London. Mayor John de Stodi, a vintner, prepared great celebrations for the Prince and the King on their arrival in London. The mayor and the aldermen went out to meet the royal party and to escort them into the city. The aldermen were dressed in elaborate costumes of bright colours. The city's conduits were filled with wine. The houses were decorated with armour and bows. Gold and silver leaves were scattered by beautiful girls sitting in specially made birdcages, hung above the roads and lanes, and crowds thronged the streets. Everyone wanted to see this procession, one of the greatest public events in their lives. And along with the King of France and the prince's train of prisoners were his young son Philip and three other members of the French royal family. 8 other counts had been captured in the battle, and of course, King David of Scotland was still in custody. The sum of all these captive kings and great lords, plus the visiting lords attached to this amazing spectacle, made London the centre of European attention, and it led to a whole season worth of festivities, beginning with a great tournament up in Smithfield. Edward could be said to wear three crowns now, as the old prophecy had foretold, for a captive king was seated on either side of him during the feasts. The 17-year-old Geoffrey Chaucer was very probably one of the many thousands who watched that tournament, as by now the future poet had become a page in the household of the wife of the king's son Lionel. Edward III, then, was a king who had one foot in the medieval era. I mean, his need to cling and enforce the old societal structures, even at the point of economic ruination of many parts of it, was proof of that. But he was also a man looking forward to the rest of the 14th century. His patronage of the arts and his building programs and innovations proved that. But his Renaissance, while not as long-lasting or as profound as the Italian one, did recreate England. For the first time ever, England was a power upon Christendom. And it was manifest in that absolute and utterly glorious celebration that descended upon London. I mean, picture it, the wildness of this party. Imagine if England won the World Cup, but multiply that 10 times over. This was an explosion of joy. And with that image in our minds, that glorious celebration taking place on the streets of our city, I'm going to leave it there. Of course, the good times were not expected to last. But let's leave London in 1347 having one hell of a party, eh? They deserve some good news occasionally. That's it. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode of The Story of London. I hope you were able to follow this one. It's a bit meaty, but I think it was worth it. All right, this is Saul. I'll see you then. Bye.